ISIS Audiobooks presents an unabridged recording of Eric, written by Terry Pratchett, read by Stephen Briggs. The bees of death are big and black. They buzz low and somber. They keep their honey in combs of wax as white as altar candles. The honey is black as night, thick as sin, and sweet as treacle. It is well known that eight colours make up white, but there are also eight colours of darkness for those that have the seeing of them, and the hives of death are among the black grass, in the black orchard, under the black-blossomed ancient boughs of trees that will eventually produce apples that, put it like this, probably won't be red. The grass was short now. The scythe that had done the work leaned against the gnarled bole of a pear tree. Now death was inspecting his bees, gently lifting the combs in his skeletal fingers. A few bees buzzed around him. Like all beekeepers, death wore a veil. It wasn't that he had anything to sting, but sometimes a bee would get inside his skull and buzz around and give him a headache. As he held a comb up to the grey light of his little world between the realities, there was the faintest of tremors. A hum went up from the hive, a leaf floated down. A wisp of wind blew for a moment through the orchard, and that was the most uncanny thing, because the air in the land of death is always warm and still. Death fancied that he heard, very briefly, the sound of running feet, and a voice saying, no, a voice thinking, oh shit, oh shit, oh shit, I'm going to die, I'm going to die, I'm going to die. Death is almost the oldest creature in the universe, with habits and modes of thought that mortal man cannot begin to understand. But because he was also a good beekeeper, he carefully replaced the comb in its rack and put the lid on the hive before reacting. He strode back through the dark garden to his cottage, removed the veil, carefully dislodged a few bees who had got lost in the depths of his cranium, and retired to his study. As he sat down at his desk, there was another rush of wind, which rattled the hourglasses on the shelves and made the big pendulum clock in the hall pause ever so briefly in its interminable task of slicing time into manageable bits. Death sighed and focused his gaze. There is nowhere death will not go, no matter how distant and dangerous. In fact, the more dangerous it is, the more likely he is to be there already. Now he stared through the mists of time and space.
"Oh," he said, "it's him."
It was a hot afternoon in late summer in Ankh-Morpork, normally the most thriving, bustling, and above all the most crowded city on the disk. Now the spears of the sun had achieved what innumerable invaders, several civil wars, and the curfew law had never achieved. It had pacified the place. Dogs lay panting in the scalding shade. The River Ankh, which never what you might call sparkled, oozed between its banks as if the heat had sucked all the spirit out of it. The streets were empty, oven brick hot. No enemies had ever taken Ankh-Morpork. Well, technically they had quite often. The city welcomed free-spending barbarian invaders, but somehow the puzzled raiders always found, after a few days, that they didn't own their own horses any more, and within a couple of months they were just another minority group with its own graffiti and food shops. But the heat had besieged the city and triumphed over the walls. It lay over the trembling streets like a shroud. Under the blow-lamp of the sun, assassins were too tired to kill. It turned thieves honest. In the ivy-covered fastness of Unseen University, Premier College of Wizardry, the inmates dozed with their pointy hats over their faces. Even blue bottles were too exhausted to bang against window panes. The city siestered, awaiting the sunset and the brief, hot, velvet surcease of the night. Only the librarian was cool. He was also swinging and hanging out. This was because he'd rigged up a few ropes and rings in one of the sub-basements of the Unseen University Library. The one where they kept the, erotic books. Just erotic, nothing kinky. It's the difference between using a feather and using a chicken. In vats of crushed ice, and he was dreamily dangling in the chilly vapour above them. All books of magic have a life of their own. Some of the really energetic ones can't simply be chained to the bookshelves. They have to be nailed shut or kept between steel plates. Or, in the case of the volumes on tantric sex magic for the serious connoisseur, kept under very cold water to stop them bursting into flames and scorching their severely plain covers. The librarian swung gently back and forth above the seething vats, dozing peacefully. Then the footsteps came out of nowhere, raced across the floor with a noise that scraped the raw surface of the sole, and disappeared through the wall. There was a faint, distant scream that sounded like, "Oh gods, oh gods, oh gods, this is it, I'm going to die." The librarian woke up, lost his grip, and flopped into the few inches of tepid water that was all that stood between the joy of tantric sex with illustrations for the advanced student by a lady and spontaneous combustion. And it would have gone badly for him if the librarian had been a human being. Fortunately, he was currently an orangutan. With so much raw magic sloshing around in the library, it would be surprising if accidents did not happen sometimes, and one particularly impressive one had turned him into an ape. Not many people get the chance to leave the human race while still alive, and he'd strenuously resisted all efforts since to turn him back. Since he was the only librarian in the universe who could pick up books with his feet, the university hadn't pressed the point. It also meant that his idea of desirable female companionship now looked something like a sack of butter thrown through a roll of old inner tubes, and so he was lucky to get away with only mild burns, a headache, and some rather ambivalent feelings about cucumbers, which wore off by tea time. In the library above, the grimoire creaked and rustled their pages in astonishment as the invisible runner passed straight through the bookshelves and disappeared, or rather, disappeared even more. Ankh-Morpork gradually awoke from its slumber. Something invisible and yelling at the top of its voice was passing through every part of the city, dragging in its wake a trail of destruction. Wherever it went, things changed. A fortune-teller in the Street of Cunning Artificers heard the footsteps run across her bedroom floor and found her crystal ball had turned into a little glass sphere with a cottage in it, plus snowflakes. In a quiet corner of the Mended Drum Tavern, where the adventuresses Herenna the Henna-haired Harridan, Red Charon, and Diome, Witch of the Night, were meeting for some girl talk and a game of canasta, all the drinks turned into small yellow elephants.
"Some wizards up at the university," said the barman, hastily replacing the glasses. "It oughtn't to be a lad."
Midnight dropped off the clock. The Council of Wizardry rubbed their eyes and stared blearily at one another. They felt it oughtn't to be allowed, too, especially since they weren't the ones that were allowing it. Finally, the new Arch-Chancellor, Ezrolith Chern, suppressed a yawn, sat up straight in his chair, and tried to look suitably magisterial. He knew he wasn't really Arch-Chancellor material. He hadn't really wanted the job. He was 98, and had achieved this worthwhile age by carefully not being any trouble or threats to anyone. He had hoped to spend his twilight years completing his 7-volume treatise on some little-known aspects of Kuian rain-making rituals, which were an ideal subject for academic study, in his opinion, since the rituals only ever worked in Ku, and that particular continent had slipped into the ocean several thousand years ago. It took 30 years to subside. The inhabitants spent a lot of the time wading. It went down in history as the multiverse's most embarrassing continental catastrophe. The trouble was that in recent years the lifespan of arch-chancellors seemed to be a bit on the short side, and the natural ambition of all wizards for the job had given way to a curious self-effacing politeness. He'd come down one morning to find everyone calling him Sir. It had taken him days to find out why. His head ached. He felt it was several weeks past his bedtime, but he had to say something.
"Gentlemen," he began, "hook. Sorry, and hook. I mean, apes, of course, hook."
The Arch-Chancellor opened and shut his mouth in silence for a while, trying to reroute his train of thought. The librarian was, ex officio, a member of the College Council. No one had been able to find any rule about orangutans being barred, although they had surreptitiously looked very hard for one.
"It's a haunting," he ventured. "Some sort of a ghost, maybe. A bell, book and candle job."
The bursar sighed.
"We tried that, Arch-Chancellor."
The Arch-Chancellor leaned towards him.
"Eh?" he said.
"I said we tried that, Arch-Chancellor," said the bursar loudly, directing his voice at the old man's ear. "After dinner, you remember? We used Hump Temper's Names of the Ants and rang Old Tom."
Old Tom was the single cracked bronze bell in the university bell tower. The clapper dropped out shortly after it was cast, but the bell still tolled out some tremendously sonorous silences every hour.
Did we indeed? The work did it?
No, Arch-Chancellor. Eh? Anyway, we've never had any trouble with ghosts before, said the senior tutor. Wizards just don't haunt places.
The Arch-Chancellor groped for a crumb of comfort.
Perhaps it's just something natural, he said. Possibly the rumblings of an underground spring. Earth movements, perhaps. Something in the drains. They can make very funny noises, you know, when their wind is in the right direction.
He sat back and beamed. The rest of the council exchanged glances.
The drains don't sound like hurrying feet, Arch-Chancellor, said the bursar wearily. Unless someone left a tap running, said the senior tutor.
The bursar scowled at him. He'd been in the tub when the invisible screaming thing had hurtled through his room. It was not an experience he wanted to repeat. The Arch-Chancellor nodded at him.
That's settled, then, he said, and fell asleep.
The bursar watched him in silence. Then he pulled the old man's hat off and tucked it gently under his head.
Well, he said wearily, has anyone got any suggestions?
The librarian put his hand up.
Hook, he said.
Yes, well done, good boy, said the bursar breezily. Anyone else?
The orangutan glared at him as the other wizards shook their heads.
It's a tremor in the texture of reality, said the senior tutor. That's what it is. What shall we do about it, then? Search me, unless we tried the old... Oh, no, said the bursar. Don't say it. Please, it's far too dangerous.
His words were chopped off by a scream that began at the far end of the room and dopplered along the table, accompanied by the sound of many running feet. The wizards ducked in a scatter of overturned chairs. The candle flames were drawn into long, thin tongues of octarine light before being snuffed out. Then there was silence, the special kind that you get after a really unpleasant noise. And the bursar said,
All right, I give in. We will try the rite of Ashk-Ente.
It is the most serious ritual 8 wizards can undertake. It summons Death, who naturally knows everything that is going on everywhere. And of course, it's done with reluctance, because senior wizards are generally very old and would prefer not to do anything to draw Death's attention in their direction. It took place at midnight in the university's great hall, in a welter of incense, candlesticks, runic inscriptions and magic circles, none of which was strictly necessary, but which made the wizards feel better. Magic flared, the chants were chanted, the invocations were truly invoked. The wizards stared into the magic octagram, which remained empty. After a while, the circle of robed figures began to mutter amongst themselves.
We must have done something wrong.
Ook.
Maybe he's out. Or busy.
Do you think we should give up and go back to bed?
Who are we waiting for, exactly?
The bursar turned slowly to the figure beside him. You could always tell a wizard's robe. It was bedecked with sequins, sigils, fur and lace, and there was usually a considerable amount of wizard inside it. This robe, however, was very black. The material looked as though it had been chosen for its hard-wearing qualities. So did its owner. He looked as though, if he wrote a diet book, it would be a best-seller. Death was watching the octagram with an expression of polite interest.
Said the bursar. The fact is, in fact, that, you should be on the inside. I'm so sorry.
Death stalked in a dignified way into the centre of the room and watched the bursar expectantly.
I hope we are not going to have any of this foul fiend business again, he said. I trust we're not interrupting any important enterprise, said the bursar politely. All my work is important, said Death.
Naturally, said the bursar.
To somebody.
The reason, oh foul, sir, that we have called you here is for the reason...
It is Rincewind.
What?
The reason you summoned me. The answer is... It is Rincewind.
But we haven't asked you the question yet.
Nevertheless, the answer is... It is Rincewind.
Look, what we want to know is, what's causing this outbreak of...
Death pointedly picked invisible particles off the edge of his scythe. The Arch-Chancellor cupped a gnarled hand over his ear.
"What did he say? Who's the fellow with the stick?"
"It's death, Arch-Chancellor," said the bursar patiently.
"Eh?
It's death, sir, you know."
"Tell him we don't want any,"
said the old wizard, waving his stick. The bursar sighed.
"We summoned him, Arch-Chancellor."
"Is it? What are we going to do that for? Bloody silly thing to do."
The bursar gave death an embarrassed grin. He was on the point of asking him to excuse the Arch-Chancellor on account of his age, but realised that this would, in the circumstances, be a complete waste of breath.
Are we talking about the wizard, Rincewind? The one with the—"
the bursar gave a shudder.
"Horrible luggage on legs? But he got blown up when there was all that business with the sorcerer, didn't he?"
The bursar was referring obliquely to the difficult occasion when the university very nearly caused the end of the world, and would in fact have done so had it not been for a chain of events involving Rincewind, a magic carpet, and a half-brick in a sock. See sorcery. The whole affair was very embarrassing to wizards, as it always is to people who find out afterwards that they were on the wrong side all along, i.e. the one that lost. And it was remarkable how many of the university's senior staff were now adamant that at the time they'd been off sick, visiting their aunt, or doing research with the door locked while humming loudly, and had had no idea what was going on outside. There had been some desultory talk about putting up a statue to Rincewind, but by the curious alchemy that tends to apply in these sensitive issues, this quickly became a plaque, then a note in the roll of honour, and finally a motion of censure for being improperly dressed.
"Into the dungeon dimensions. And now he is trying to get back home."
"Can he do that?"
"There would need to be an unusual conjunction of circumstances. Reality would need to be weakened in certain unexpected ways."
That isn't likely to happen, is it?"
said the bursar anxiously. People who have it on record that they were visiting their aunt for 2 months are always nervous about people turning up who may have mistakenly thought that they weren't, and, owing to some trick of the light, might have believed that they had seen them doing things that they couldn't have been doing owing to being at their aunt's.
"It would be a 1,000,000-to-1 chance," said Death. "Exactly a 1,000,000-to-1 chance."
"Oh," said the bursar, intensely relieved. "Oh, dear. What a shame."
He brightened up considerably.
"Of course. There's all the noise, but, unfortunately, I expect he won't survive for long."
"This could be the case," said Death blandly. "I am sure, though, that you would not wish me to make a practice of issuing definitive statements in this field."
No, of course not," said the bursar hurriedly. "Right, well, many thanks. Poor chap, what a great pity. Still, can't be helped. Perhaps we should be philosophical about these things."
"Perhaps you should."
"And we had better not keep you," the bursar added politely.
"Thank you."
"Goodbye."
"Be seeing you."
In fact, the noise stopped just before breakfast. The librarian was the only one unhappy about it. Rincewind had been his assistant and his friend, and was a good man when it came to peeling a banana. He had also been uniquely good at running away from things. He was not, the librarian considered, the type to be easily caught. There had probably been an unusual conjunction of circumstances. That was a far more likely explanation. There had been an unusual conjunction of circumstances. By exactly a 1,000,000-to-1 chance, there had been someone watching, studying, looking for the right tools for a special job. And here was Rincewind. It was almost too easy. So Rincewind opened his eyes. There was a ceiling above him. If it was the floor, then he was in trouble. So far, so good. He cautiously felt the surface he was lying on. It was grainy, woody, in fact, with the odd nail hole. A human sort of surface. His ears picked up the crackle of a fire, and a bubbling noise, source unknown. His nose, feeling that it was being let out of things, hastened to report a whiff of brimstone. Right, so where did that leave him? Lying on a rough wooden floor in a firelit room with something that bubbled and gave off sulphurous smells. In his unreal, dreamy state, he felt quite pleased at this process of deduction. What else? Oh, yes. He opened his mouth and screamed and screamed and screamed. This made him feel slightly better. He lay there a bit longer. Through the tumbled heap of his memories came the recollections of mornings in bed when he was a little boy, desperately subdividing the passing time into smaller and smaller units to put off the terrible moment of getting up and having to face all the problems of life, such as, in this case, who he was, where he was, and why he was.
"What are you?"
said a voice on the edge of his consciousness. "I was coming to that," muttered Rincewind. The room oscillated into focus as he pushed himself up on his elbows.
"I warn you," said the voice, which seemed to be coming from a table, "I am protected by many powerful amulets."
"Oh, jolly good," said Rincewind. "I wish I was." Details began to distill out of the blur. It was a long, low room, one end of which was entirely occupied by an enormous fireplace. A bench all down one wall contained a selection of glassware apparently created by a drunken glassblower with hiccups, and inside its Byzantine coils coloured liquids seethed and bubbled. A skeleton hung from a hook in a relaxed fashion. On a perch beside it, someone had nailed a stuffed bird. Whatever sins it had committed in life, it hadn't deserved what the taxidermist had done to it. Rincewind's gaze then swept across the floor. It was obvious that it was the only sweeping the floor had had for some time. Only around him had space been cleared among the debris of broken glass and overturned retorts for a magic circle. It looked an extremely thorough job. Whoever had chalked it was clearly very aware that its purpose was to divide the universe into two bits, the inside and the outside. A Rincewind was, of course, inside. "Ah," he said, feeling a familiar and almost comforting sense of helpless dread sweep over him.
"I adjure and conjure thee against all aggressive acts, O demon of the pit," said the voice from, Rincewind now realised, behind the table.
"Fine, fine," said Rincewind quickly. "That's all right by me. It isn't possible that there's been the teeniest little mistake here, could there?"
"Avaunt."
"Right," said Rincewind. He looked around desperately.
"How? Don't you think you can lure me to my doom with thy lying tongue, O fiend of Shamharoth?" said the table. "I am learned in the ways of demons. Obey my every command, or I will return thee unto the boiling hell from which you came. Thou came, sorry. Thou camest, in fact. And I really mean it."
The figure stepped out. It was quite short, and most of it was hidden by a variety of charms, amulets, and talismans, which, even if not effective against magic, would probably have protected it against a tolerably determined sword thrust. It wore glasses, and had a hat with long side pieces that gave it the air of a short-sighted spaniel. It held a sword in one shaking hand. It was so heavily etched with sigils that it was beginning to bend.
"Boiling hell, did you say?"
said Rincewind weakly.
"Absolutely. Where the screams of anguish and the tortured torments—"
"Yes, yes, you've made your point," said Rincewind. "Only, you see, the thing is, in fact, that I'm not a demon. So if you would just let me out—"
"I am not fooled by thy outer garb, demon,"
said the figure. In a more normal voice it added,
"Anyway, demons always lie. Well-known fact."
"It is," said Rincewind, clutching at this straw. "In that case, then, I am a demon."
"Aha! Condemned out of your own mouth."
"Look, I don't have to put up with this," said Rincewind. "I don't know who you are or what's happening, but I'm going to have a drink, all right." He went to walk out of the circle and went rigid with shock as sparks crackled up from the runic inscriptions and earthed themselves all over his body.
Thou masont,
the conjurer of demons gave up.
"Look, you can't step over the circle until I release you, right? I mean, I don't want to be unpleasant. It's just that if I let you out of the circle, you will be able to resume your true shape. And a pretty awful shape it is too, I expect. Avaunt,"
he added, feeling that he wasn't keeping up the tone.
"All right, I'm a-vaunting, said Rincewind, rubbing his elbow. "But I'm still not a demon."
"How come you answered the conjuration, then? I suppose you just happened to be passing through the paranatural dimensions, eh?"
"Something like that, I think. It's all a bit blurred."
"Pull the other one. It has got bells on."
The conjurer leaned his sword against a lectern on which a heavy book, dripping bookmarks, lay open. Then he did a mad little jig on the floor.
"It worked," he said.
He caught sight of Rincewind's horrified gaze and pulled himself together. He gave an embarrassed cough and stepped up to the lectern.
"I really am not," Rincewind began.
"I had this list here somewhere," said the figure. Let's see now. Oh, yes, I command you, thee, I mean, grant me three wishes, yes. I want mastery of the kingdoms of the world. I want to meet the most beautiful woman who has ever lived, and I want to live forever.
He gave Rincewind an encouraging look. All that, said Rincewind.
Yes.
Oh, no problem, said Rincewind sarcastically. And then I get the rest of the day off, right?
And I want a chest full of gold, too, just to be going on with.
I can see you've got it all thought out.
Yes. Avaunt.
Right, right. Only, Rincewind thought hurriedly, he's quite mad. But mad with a sword in his hands, the only chance I've got is to argue him out of it on his own terms. Only, do you see, I'm not a very superior kind of demon, and I'm afraid those sort of errands are a bit out of my league, sorry. You can avaunt as much as you like, but they're just beyond me. The little figure peered over the top of its glasses.
I see, he said testily. What could you manage, then, do you think?
Well, said Rincewind, I suppose I could go down to the shops and get you a packet of mints or something. There was a pause.
You really can't do all those things?
Sorry. Look, I'll tell you what. You just release me, and I'll be sure to pass the word around when I get back to... Rincewind hesitated. Where the hell did demons live, anyway? Demon City, he said hopefully.
You mean Pandemonium? Said his captor suspiciously.
Yes, that's right. That's what I meant. I'll tell everyone, next time you're in the real world, be sure and look up... what's your name?
Thursley. Eric Thursley.
Right.
Demonologist. Midden Lane, Pseudopolis. Next door to the tannery, said Thursley, hopefully.
Right you are. Don't you worry about it. Now, if you'll just let me out... Thursley's face fell.
You're sure you really can't do it, he said,
and Rincewind couldn't help noticing the edge of pleading in his voice.
Even a small chest of gold would do. And I mean, it needn't be the most beautiful one in the whole of history. Second most beautiful would do, or third. You can pick any one out of, you know, the top 100,000. Whatever you've got in stock sort of thing.
By the end of the sentence, his voice twanged with longing. Rincewind wanted to say, look, what you should do is stop all this messing around with chemicals in dark rooms and have a shave, a haircut, a bath, make that two baths, buy yourself a new wardrobe and get out of an evening, and then... But he'd have to be honest, because even washed, shaved and soaked in body splash, Thursley wasn't going to win any prizes. And then you could have your face slapped by any woman of your choice. I mean, it wouldn't be much, but it would be body contact.
Sorry, he said again.
Thursley sighed.
The kettle's on, he said. Would you like a cup of tea?
Rincewind stepped forward into a crackle of psychic energy.
Ah,
said Thursley uncertainly, as the wizard sucked at his fingers.
I'll tell you what, I'll put you under a conjuration of duress.
There's no need, I assure you.
No, it's best this way. It means you can move around. I had it all ready anyway, in case you could go and fetch, you know, her.
Fine, said Rincewind. As the demonologist mumbled words from the book, he thought, feet, door, stairs. What a great combination. It occurred to him that there was something about the demonologist that wasn't quite usual, but he couldn't put his finger on it. He looked pretty much like the demonologists Rincewind had known back in Ankh-Morpork, who were all bent and chemical-stained and had eyes with pupils like pinheads from all the chemical fumes. This one would have fitted in easily. It was just that there was something odd.
"To be honest," said Thursley, industriously mopping away part of the circle, "you're my first demon. It's never worked before. What is your name?"
"Rincewind." Thursley thought about this.
"It doesn't ring a bell," he said. "There's a Rincewind in the demonology, and a Winswin, but they've got more wings than you. You can step out now. I must say that that's a first-class materialisation. No one would think you were a fiend to look at you. Most demons, when they want to look human, materialise in the shape of nobles, kings and princes. This moth-eaten wizard look is very clever. You could have almost fooled me. It's a shame you can't do any of those things."
"I can't see why you'd want to live forever," said Rincewind, privately determining that the words moth-eaten would be paid for if ever he got the opportunity. "Being young again, I can understand that."
"Ha! Being young's not much fun," said Thursley,
and then clapped his hand over his mouth. Rincewind leaned forward. "About
50 years. That was what was missing. "That's a false beard," he said. "How old are you?"
87, squeaked Thursley. "I can see the hooks over your ears."
78, honest, avaunt.
You're a little boy.
Eric pulled himself up haughtily.
I'm not, he snapped. I'm nearly 14.
Aha!
The boy waved the sword at Rincewind.
It doesn't matter anyway, he shouted. Demonologists can be any age. You're still my demon, and you have to do as I say.
Eric?
Came a voice from somewhere below them. Eric's face went white.
Yes, Mother,
he shouted, his eyes fixed on Rincewind. His mouth shaped the words, Don't say anything, please.
What's all that noise up there?
Nothing, Mother.
Come down and wash your hands, dear. Your breakfast ready.
Yes, Mother.
He looked sheepishly at Rincewind.
That's my mother, he said.
She's got a good pair of lungs, hasn't she? Said Rincewind.
I'd better go then, said Eric. You'll have to stay up here, of course.
It dawned on him that he was losing a certain amount of credibility at this point. He waved the sword again.
Avaunt, he said. I command you not to leave this room.
Right, sure, said Rincewind, eyeing the windows.
Promise? Otherwise you'll be sent back to the pit.
Oh, I don't want that, said Rincewind. Off you trot. Don't worry about me.
I'm going to leave the sword and stuff here, said Eric,
removing most of his accoutrements to reveal a slim, dark-haired young man whose face would be a lot better when his acne cleared up.
If you touch them, terrible things will befall.
Wouldn't dream of it, said Rincewind.